You're going to present a lecture to us on the Battle of the Gods, a comparative study of narrative techniques in Macaulay painting.
This is not the best title. No, thank you, Gavin. And I should start with thanking the OCHS for having me here as a fellow. It's just been a most wonderful 5 weeks so far. And I think I speak for Dan and me.
Indeed.
So some of you were here for Dan's talk as well. And obviously big shoes to fill. But some of the issues that Dan brought up in his talk, where he's showing the compositional similarities that appear in manuscripts made at different places and different times, and how important it is to not be confined by the sort of silos that the discipline has created. I think this is you'll see that's an undercurrent in my talk as well, because I'm comparing two different formats of painted material, a manuscript and a scroll. And I have lots of images, so, and feel free to stop me when you want, if you want to talk about an image, etc. I just have lots of pretty pictures. So while exploring the collections at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, I was struck by four dazzling illustrations where splendid architecture and dramatic landscapes in rainbow colors served as the backdrop as Krishna hunted and married beautiful princesses. These stories from the latter half of the 10th book of the Bhagavad Puran were familiar to me from manuscripts produced at the Rajput courts in the Punjab hills and in central India. But here, Krishna had been transposed into the rich and brilliant world of Nepali painting and occupied the cities and palaces of the Kathmandu Valley, his presence bearing testimony to the wide sphere of the Bhagavad circulation and influence. The PMA's four illustrations and the lavish Nepali manuscript to which they belong have never been investigated in detail, and more than a few folios are rarely examined together. And this is despite the long history of Vaishnavism in Nepal, the ubiquity of artworks dedicated to Vishnu and his incarnations, and this Bhagavat's participation in a broader North Indian engagement with the Krishna legend, which saw an unprecedented proliferation of illustrated Bhagavats during the late 17th and 18th centuries. Moreover, the manuscript is visually spectacular and a singular example in Nepal's canon. Yes, maybe we.
Sorry about
this. No, absolutely no problem. So, in this talk, I will be examining the episodes leading up to and including the Battle of the Gods between Krishna and Shiva that takes place in chapters 62 and 63 of the 10th book, alongside a scroll that portrays the Harivamsha's version of the encounter. By comparing visualization of space and place, storytelling techniques and style, I will probe how the manuscript's organization and narrative rhythm derive at least partially from the features it shares with Hindu and Buddhist scrolls. Now, while Vaishnavism might not have been the dominant religion of the Kathmandu Valley, it was patronized by its rulers, some of whom were Vaishnav and adopted Vishnu's titles and names as their laudatory titles. Archaeologically, the history of Vaishnavism in Nepal can be traced back to the 5th century, when two inscribed and dated Vishnu icons were consecrated by the king Manadeva in honor of his mother. Inscriptional evidence suggests that by the 7th century, important Vishnu temples, including the Changu Narayana, existed, and by the 10th century, standardized Vishnu icons were prevalent. We know from Ludo Rocha, of course, that the Bhagavad was translated into Nepali. Other texts, including the epics and the Harivamsha, were also copied during the early modern period. And there were certain rites and rituals, such as the Anantavrata, that were very significant in the valley. Also certain iconographic types, like the four-armed Vishnu with the conch shell in the lower hand rather than sorry, you can't see the pointer here, but that's the conch shell in the lower hand, is typical of Nepal. It's not something that you see often in the Indian context. Painted depictions of the Krishna Leela in Nepal are known from circa 1600, one of the earliest being this Kala Pustaka, which is currently at Cambridge. This would open up like an accordion fold thing. It's 72 illustrations on 36 folded sheets, which would just open up like a concertina, I think they're called. There are also episodes from Krishna's life depicted in scrolls, such as this Usha Anirudh episode from the Harivamsa. There are scrolls that depict rituals such as the Anantavrata. And there are also certain iconic forms that find depiction in scrolls in Nepal. So there's definitely an interest in visualizing the Krishna legend during the early modern period. But among these extant two-dimensional works, the Nepali Bhagavat is distinct in terms of its format, because typically you have scrolls or concertinas, so a manuscript format, the Pothi format, is unusual. And also when we compare the density of folios and its general lavishness to contemporary illustrated Bhagavats produced across North India, it is an extraordinary thing. Nevertheless, this singular manuscript has not been explored in context since the late 1970s. And in recent decades, folios from this manuscript mainly appear in auction catalogs, museum catalogs, collectors' catalogs. And the few scholars that engage with the manuscript typically identify and describe episodes, mention the influence of Indian painting, label the set as stylistically unique, or point to stylistic elements it has in common with Indian and Nepali painting. And I think this is more relevant to Andrew and Dan's understanding. But for example, Pratap Pal has said that he noticed elements from Mewar painting and Rajasthani painting more generally. On the other hand, the physiognomy of the figures and the architecture and palette for him are typically Nepali. Jack Sewell, on the other hand, suggests a Malwa or Guler Basoli influence. So these observations show the wide range of paintings artists in Nepal may have had access to and the variegated motifs and forms that coalesce in the Bhagavat illustrations. However, since each conclusion is based only on a small handful of paintings, contradictory opinions often arise, because Guler Basoli and Malwa in the same painting it's a pretty unusual coming together of elements. Moreover, very little time is spent in decoding the artist's compositional, iconographic, and storytelling strategies, not just in one or two illustrations, but broader trends that become visible only when a large number of folios is examined together. I also want to just alert you to how vast this manuscript actually is. I found about 50 folios from different points in the manuscript. The numbers that I've noticed cross 140, and the chapters I've noticed it covering are chapters 50 to 63. So it's 14 chapters with 140 folios. So if the entire latter half of the 10th book was covered, that is 41 chapters, there might have been 400 folios originally, making it an absolutely monumental commission. I mean, I think it would be one of the largest we would have heard of, maybe comparable to the Mewar Ramayan currently mostly at the British Library. But even if it was just 63 chapters, it's a pretty extensive set when you compare it to others. So I'm going to spend a little time actually telling you the story of Usha Anirudh and the Battle of the Gods, and I'll be taking you through the paintings that where the story is depicted. And again, if you feel you need to stop me somewhere or if you don't understand something, do let me know. But I just thought showing pictures and telling stories is a lot more fun than you just listening to my voice go on. So the story opens in chapter 62, where we have Banasur, the thousand-armed ruler of Shonitapura, propitiating Shiva by playing various instruments with his thousand hands as Shiva dances the Tandava out here. And you can see you have Shiva's ganas next to him who are also playing instruments as Shiva dances. Now, Shiva is very pleased with Bana's, this expression of devotion, and he grants Bana a boon. And Bana says, I want you to be a permanent guardian in my city. And Shiva acquiesces. So that is the scene you have depicted here in the mountainous landscape, probably of Kailasha. And you'll find that there are captions written at the bottom in Nepali. These are actually telling you what's happening in the painting. There's nothing on the back of these folios. There's nothing on the verso at all, not even on the first folio from the manuscript. But often these captions will contain a little detail that is not visualized or is so specific that it can't be visualized. So, for example, this caption will tell you that Bana is the eldest son of the king of Asuras, Bali. But that's not a detail which is presented in the illustration. But throughout, you'll find the captions include these little, very specific textual details from the Sanskrit. You'll also find folio numbers written in the top left and bottom right corners. There is some evidence of overwriting in these folio numbers, so it's a bit difficult to fully understand yet what happened. Maybe at some time the set was reordered or something like that. Moving on, we find that here are Shiva and Parvati installed in Banasur's capital city. And one day Banasur comes and bows down to Shiva and says, Shiva, I'm really tired of my thousand arms. Oh, Lord Shiva, I'm really tired of my thousand arms. They are becoming a burden to me. There is no one worthy that I can fight with. And of course, Shiva is incensed. He gets very angry and he says, I'm warning you, one day an equal of mine will come and defeat you in battle. And this is exactly what Bana wanted to hear. And he goes and happily awaits the encounter in his palace again, because this is what he wants. Now, while this is going on, we are told in the Bhagavad that Bana has a daughter called Usha, and she has a dream where she has intercourse with this gorgeous man, and waking up, she is desperately searching for him but can't find him anywhere. And she is absolutely bereft and desperately in love and unable to find her beloved anywhere. And that is a picture I do not have here, unfortunately. But the next moment in the story, and I do apologize, but this is from a PDF and I haven't been able to gain access to the actual image. But here we see on the extreme left, you have Shiva installed in the city with Parvati. Then you have Banasur's chamber. Somehow this pointer isn't working very well. You have Banasur in the chamber, his thousand arms. He's sleeping. It's a moonlit night. And then moving further, you have Usha. Let me see if I can use the... No. You have Usha... sitting in her palace, and her companion Chitralekha is painting the portraits of the various orders of men. She paints yakshas, gandharvas, devas, nagas, asuras, and finally she comes to men, and she starts painting the vrishnis, etc. And coming to the yadavas, finally she paints Krishna, and Usha says, yes, we're getting close. Then she paints Pradyumna, and finally she gets to Anirudh, and Usha says very shyly, out here, that yes, this is the man I dreamt of. This is the man that I want to marry. So Chitralekha, who is her best friend and possesses magical yogic powers, says, okay, I'll bring this man to you. And she goes off to Dwarka, the city of doors, as it is described in some places. And finding the sleeping Anirudh, whom you can see in the middle of the palace, she picks him up together with his bed, and almost like a weight lifter over here, she carries him off and brings him to Shonitapur. In the palace, you see Krishna is sitting in his own chamber on the left. He's enjoying his life, probably with Rukmini, and everything else is going on, but there Anirudh is being carried away. Reaching Shonitapur, again, we have Shiva and Parvati installed in their chamber on the left. Then you have Banasur asleep, and in the dark of the night we see Chitralekha leading Anirudh into the women's chambers where Usha is waiting for him. And then Chitralekha presents Anirudh to Usha, and the two live together as husband and wife. Apparently they have a Gandharva Vivah, and they live together as husband and wife without anyone outside the women's quarters knowing what's going on. So people in Dwarka don't know, people here don't know. And they managed to enjoy life together in this way for about 4 months, I think, or a little less than that. So here you have them playing dice together. And these are probably either the women attendants or the eunuchs who ultimately complain to Barnasur. And we see there is a series of almost Chinese whisper going on here, where you see this one character who is half inside and half outside the door. Like, he's leaning inwards. He listens to what's happening. He hears that there is a man who has deflowered Usha. And he comes over here to tell Barnasur about it. That, Barnasur, your daughter is no longer a virgin. Right under your eyes, your race has been defiled. What are you going to do about it? And obviously, Barnasur is incensed. And he heads off from his palace, spies Usha and Anirudh playing dice together in the middle of this illustration. And he attacks Anirudh, as we can see on the right side. He has a sword, Anirudh picks up an iron pillar. And the Bhagavad tells us that there is a terrific encounter between first Barnasur's forces and Anirudh, and ultimately Barnasur and Anirudh. And Barnasur ties up Anirudh with these serpentine arrow binding cords. These two illustrations are not extant, or I don't have access to them, so we just have to imagine how they would have looked. Then we go on to chapter 63, and which opens with a scene in Dwarka. We have everyone for 4 months hasn't seen Anirudh, and everyone is quite desperate for him. And here we have Narad Muni coming and telling Krishna that, actually Anirudh is in Shonitapur imprisoned because of the series of events. And then the Yadava army decides to leave for Shonitapur. And again, here you have a detail in the caption that says they go with an army of 12 Akshohinis. And now this is a figure which I've been reading the Gita Press editions, and they're not able to tell me what this is equivalent to, but it is a very large army, apparently. And it's, again, to sort of suggest a much larger number than can actually be depicted in the painting. And if someone knows what that is equivalent to, I would very much appreciate it. But I haven't been able to figure it out yet. Then, when they first go to make their way to Shonitapur, they lay siege on the city. And ultimately, a terrific encounter happens between Krishna's forces and Barnasur's forces. So you have Krishna's forces on the left and Barnasur's on the right. And if we move from top to bottom, you'll see Krishna fighting Shiva. Below that, you have Pradyumna fighting Shiva's son Kartikeya. Then you have Balaram fighting Kumbhanda. Then you have Shamba, who is another son of Krishna's, fighting Bana's son. And right at the bottom, you have Satyaki, a famous Yadava warrior, fighting Barnasur. And the order in which they are arranged, top to bottom, is the same order in which they are described in the Sanskrit text. So it seems obvious that the artist is referring to the text, that the scribe is referring to the text as these illustrations are made. And out here you have Anirudh tied up in the serpentine cords. And here in the absolute corner, in the damaged bit, is Usha sitting in her palace as they watch this encounter unfold. And because Dan was talking about this last time, and you have gods in the aerial cars watching the fights. And I wanted to bring this in because Dan talked quite a lot about the comparison between compositions used in manuscripts, where you have manuscripts separated by time and place, but often showing a very similar arrangement of forms. And I don't know, Dan, if you want to talk about this at all.
But I agree with you.
I mean, it's pretty obvious here that with the palace on the right and the figures on the left, also arranged in this very,
very
proper
order.
Yes, there aren't as many in the dispersed Bhagavat manuscript, and this is an early 16th century manuscript from somewhere in North India, we will say, while the other one is a 18th century manuscript from Nepal. So the mechanisms by which such sharing might have happened are difficult to determine, but I don't know if it could just be coincidence that there is so much similarity between such compositions.
I doubt it.
Yeah. And again, right on top, the topmost pair is Krishna and Shiva. Moving down, the bottommost pair is Bana. The blackish figure is Bana. In the middle there, you can see Kartike. So there is a lot of similarity between them. Then we have battle scenes. The battle first, Krishna fights Shiva, and those pages are again not available to me yet. We have them using various divine weaponry against each other, and ultimately Krishna uses a bana which makes Shiva feel sleepy or a bit confused, and then Krishna starts destroying Bana's army. And at the bottom you can see Kartikeya is being driven away as well. Here Bana decides he will attack Krishna himself because Krishna has destroyed his army. And as the battle progresses, we see Krishna destroying his chariot, killing the charioteer, killing Bana's horses. And he is about to kill Bana when Bana's mother comes and stands in between them naked, preventing Krishna from killing Bana. Then Bana attacks, goes back into his palace, rejuvenates himself, comes back and attacks Krishna again. And ultimately, it is due to Shiva's intervention that the battle is stopped. And, you know, Shiva says, please leave him alone. He is under my protection. And ultimately, Krishna does decide to spare his life. He takes Anirudh and Usha and they go back to Dwarka, where the wedding is celebrated. And, you know, the people live happily ever after, kind of thing. And I've given you this story in some detail. And this is a scroll which is a contemporary scroll to the manuscript made in Nepal as well. And I won't go through the story in much detail here because I'll be spending too much time storytelling then. But the Harivamsha's version of the story is more detailed. There are some things that are different between them. But on the whole, I think you'll be able to follow the story as I show you these slides. Because I did spend some time preparing them, so I don't want to not show them to you, but I won't. Oh, because look at that, but I won't discuss it in detail. And by now you've learned to read them. So, yeah, the austerities. And notice in the topmost register, there'll be two stories going on, one on the roofs of the palaces and one in the bottom of the palace as well. So don't miss those things. See, there you just have that little bit of space where you have Usha sleeping, waking up, seeing the portraits, and then sending her friend off to capture, kidnap Anirudh. And there you have the actual kidnapping taking place. Here also, Chitralekha is pretty much a weightlifter, you know, carrying him on her shoulders and bringing her back. And here at the bottom, you have the eunuchs complaining to Banasur, saying your daughter is no longer a virgin. And then ultimately here you have the end of one chapter where Narada rushes off to tell Krishna and the others as Anirudh is bound up by the snakes. Moving below, we'll find the continuation when Narada has come here and is telling them. Then the army heads out into battle. And do please again, like I said, stop me if there's something you want more details of. The order in which the encounters are depicted in this Harivamsha is different from the text of the Harivamsha, because there Krishna first fights Shiva, then he fights Kartikeya, and then he fights Bana. But here he fights Bana, Kartikeya, Bana, and then Shiva. And the goddess Kotavi is the one who rescues Bana from being killed, not his mother in the text. And there is this other element of the story where Brahma has to stop the fight between Krishna and Shiva, reminding Shiva that you and Krishna are one. You are both two parts of the same soul. And there is a whole chapter devoted to this hymn that is recited to this combined form of Krishna and Shiva. And what I find very interesting in this part of the narrative is that after all this, Bana dances for Shiva and he's given five boons. As in, he's done all this bad stuff by fighting against Krishna, but still he gets to enjoy five boons from Shiva. And that's Shiva granting him these boons. In the meantime, Krishna is rescuing Anirudh, and you can see the snakes are so scared of Garuda that they slither away from binding Anirudh. And you can see one snake over here, I think. It's quite clearly depicted. Here we have the scene of Anirudh and Usha being married, and ultimately they return to Dwarka as Bana goes away with Shiva. So this is a slightly different version of the story and a slightly different format. But I thought it's important to tell you so that I can do the comparison between the scroll and the manuscript. So this is the first folio from the manuscript, and you can and it's distinguished by the presence of Ganesh in the top left corner of the illustration. The god is larger than all the other figures and is clearly recognizable, you know, by his elephant head, as well as the inscription above his head that reads Shri Ganesh. And as we all know, in India and Nepal, Ganesh is regarded as the remover of obstacles and is worshipped at the start of an enterprise to ensure its success. For this reason, he is regularly featured on the first folio or the cover of Indian manuscripts, including illustrated Bhagavats. In Nepal, a salutation to Ganesh will usually open Hindu as well as Buddhist texts, and he often enjoys a place of prominence on the book covers of both. But his placement here, in a corner rather than centrally, sharing the stage with the narrative action that unfolds in the lower part of the illustration, is unlike any representation in the illustrated manuscripts I have encountered. Instead, I believe the arrangement is related to the way Nepali narrative scrolls are composed and used. When narrative scrolls, both vertically and horizontally orientated ones, comprise more than one register, they are read left to right and top to bottom. In this scroll, he presides over the, you can see him in the top left corner where the narrative begins, and the rest of the story unfolds from there. We saw him already in the Harivamsha scroll that we looked at earlier. So I feel that his placement in this painting, in the top left corner, is where the narrative is imagined as beginning, or where the narrative begins in scrolls. He's on the first folio, which is the beginning, but he's placed where in scrolls the narrative would begin. And I feel the artist who made this was probably someone who was more familiar with painting scrolls and put him in that corner over there. Next to Ganesh are the two figures, Shukadev and Parikshit, that Dan alluded to last time, you know. The royal interlocutor and the commentator of the Bhagavad. And we will see that they also occur very often in illustrated Bhagavats. So, for example, they might come at the beginning on the first folio, you know, opening the narrative, as it were. Or they might come multiple times within a manuscript, often marking the beginning of a chapter. And I think they appear in your dispersed Bhagavat as well, don't they? But not marking the chapters, necessarily. In
leaflets and
okay. And I've seen them twice in the Nepali Bhagavad. They once appear in the beginning of chapter 56 and once in the on the first folio. And I'm not really certain what role they perform here, but that wherever the text mentions them, we'll see them coming again. Now, Pratapaditya Pal has made the point that the same artists might execute Hindu and Buddhist subjects, and iconographic types and motifs were often transferred from one to the other. This shared visual language for Hindu and Buddhist deities can be marked in the representations of Shiva, portrayed as here with heads piled on top of another in a sort of pyramid, and with his faces having different colors. So, like, look at him here on the right. It's very similar to how he's depicted in the manuscript we just looked at. And I feel that such a depiction is more similar to Buddhist deities like Arya Avalokiteshvara and Mahasamvara. You know, where, I mean, of course, we know Shiva has multiple heads, but this sort of pyramidal arrangement and the multicolored faces is nothing that I've seen in a South Asian context as such. I feel that is an element which is borrowed from the Buddhist iconography. But in our Harivamsha scroll, he's always depicted thus. He never comes in with this multi-faced form. Now, as I mentioned earlier, the narrative in a scroll always runs left to right and top to bottom. And you'll find these trees that are acting as dividers between scenes. It's a typical motif to use scenes, you know, water bodies, architecture, etc. to create these divisions. Now, there are some folios in the Bhagavad where this scroll-like element is very apparent. You know, you have this two-register format almost, and you have the trees that divide the episodes from each other. So this is the story of the Syamantaka gem, where Satrajit prays to the sun god in order to get this gem. Then you have the sun god coming in and giving him the gem. Then you have Shukadeva and Parikshit talking to each other. And below you have him making his way back to Dwarka or Mathura. So in most cases, we'll find in the manuscript that the action moves from left to right. Occasionally, you'll find it moving in the opposite direction. But the sort of emphasis on horizontality, the division of episodes with the help of these natural barriers, is pretty marked throughout the manuscript. Now, most manuscripts in the South Asian context utilize this technique known as topographical alignment, or many do, where, say, in this manuscript, for example, one side of the page always belongs to Krishna, and the other side of the page will always belong to Banasura. So Krishna and his army will always attack from the left, as we can see in these pages, and Banasura and his forces will always be coming in from the right. But this is an element that is missing in the Nepali Bhagavat we looked at, where the action, because it always moves from left to right, we find, for example, the chamber of Usha and the chamber of Bana switch places very often. So in the second painting, it's on the right. In the third painting, it moves on to the left, and then it switches places again. So there is a different conceptualization of the way the narrative unfolds in a manuscript here, which is more similar to scrolls, where again, the narrative always travels from left to right. And the last narrative element I want to point out to you is what I call the iconography of the city that is created in the Nepali Bhagavat, where whenever Dwarka is depicted, for example, it is depicted with a water body in front of it. Now, we know that Dwarka was a city that was constructed in the middle of an ocean. And so by placing it in the middle of water or by showing a water body in front of it, it becomes clear that this is Dwarka. Again, when Shonitapur is depicted, it's always depicted with a row of flames in front of it. Even when only a corner of the city is shown, you have the flames. And I believe in some cases, Shonitapur is referred to as Agnigarh. I think in the Mahabharata, it's referred to as Agnigarh, or the fortress of fire, which is why a row of flames would be the appropriate sort of depiction over here. Mathura is always depicted with this very sort of colonial architecture and a colonial gateway on the right for some reason. I don't know how it came there. And Narkasur's capital is always depicted as this kind of circular formation, which with the various bands of fire and flames, etc., that protect it. So every city has its own way of being depicted in this manuscript. And while most other cities cluster together in the manuscript, Dwarka is one that appears throughout. So by giving you this visual iconography of the city, the artist is sort of helping you orientate yourself within the manuscript and understand what's being depicted. And we see this happening in the scroll as well, where there are only two cities to look at, but always you'll find Shonitapur has this yellow roof structure with a white dome on the side, and Dwarka always has a white dome with this kind of red roof next to it. And if you look again, you'll find it's very clear to easy to distinguish between the white dome and the yellow roof, So you know it's Dwarka, Shonitapur. So in a way, I feel the Nepali artist is adopting a lot of the techniques that are there in the scroll in order to tell the story in the manuscript. And I think one of the main points I was hoping to make in this talk is that disciplinary silos that are created, whether it is between Hindu and Buddhist, or manuscripts and scrolls, or between Mughal and Mewar, or between all the sort of larger disciplinary divide that exists between people who study text and image will often prevent us from getting a fuller picture of the society and the culture as it was unfolding. And I hope I've been able to show the textualists here that artists have a voice as well, that they use figures of speech in a way. They have their own alankaras, they have their own methods of storytelling, which have a lot of variety and a lot of beauty. And we, as art historians, have a lot of pleasure, derive a lot of pleasure from reading manuscripts and scrolls, the way texts provide pleasure to textualists. Thank you.